How would you feel if you knew that everything you did each and every day had some effect on the world around you? How would you feel if science could prove that we are all linked together somehow in the web of creation? And even further, that this web of creation is now being referred to by science as the mind of God, and that you possess the ability to tap into this incredible power. In Speaking the Lost Language of God, Awakening the Forgotten Wisdom of Prayer, Prophecy, and the Dead Sea Scrolls, visionary and scientist Greg Braden weaves state-of-the-art research with his extensive knowledge of ancient texts throughout this illuminating program where science meets spirituality to answer these questions. He takes you on a journey where science and miracles are merged into a new wisdom and lead to a startling conclusion. Greg's extensive knowledge of ancient texts, coupled with his background in hard sciences, uniquely qualify him to bring the benefits of long-lost traditions to the forefront of our lives today and in our future. By unraveling the mystery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, Greg suggests that Isaiah, the first Old Testament prophet, left precise instructions to the people of the future of how to create and claim the experiences you want that will not only benefit yourself, but your family, community, and ultimately, the world as well. Using principles recognized only recently in the scientific community, Greg also demonstrates how Isaiah's non-religious, non-denominational mode of prayer offers meaningful solutions to the challenges of our time. You'll discover the joy that comes from tapping into your power to bring wellness, abundance, health, security, and happiness to your life. In Speaking the Lost Language of God, you will learn about lost and forgotten ancient texts that have incredible relevancy to how you live your life today and your future. You'll become more aware of the moment-to-moment dialogue you are having with God. You'll discover a unique mode of prayer that empowers you to heal your life and have an effect on everything around you, and discover that the real power of prayer comes from your heart-based feelings, not just your words. You'll discover how science is reinforcing spiritual theories today and the impact these discoveries have on your personal spiritual journey. You'll discover the blueprint to understanding and changing the conditions of your life that no longer serve you. And you'll take an amazing journey of self-discovery through the matrix of Greg's knowledge of spiritual traditions. This fascinating mix of studio and live recordings introduces an empowering technology, a new approach to modern living. It offers you a new and deeper understanding of the unseen forces of thought, feeling, and emotion, and how they relate to prayer and the forces of creation. In addition to understanding how your inner technology works, you'll know how to change the elements of your experiences to better serve you in the future. This information will give new meaning to every moment of every day of your life. And now, the Nightingale Conan Corporation is very pleased to bring you Greg Braden.
Hello, my name is Greg Braden. In the mid-1980s, I found myself working in the aerospace and defense industry as a senior computer systems designer during the last years of the Cold War era. I had the opportunity to see firsthand the development of some of the most sophisticated technology known to humankind today, and at the same time, I witnessed an alarming increase in famine, the growing proportions of the world, epidemics of disease, hunger, war, suffering. It made very little sense in the presence of such advanced technologies. My thinking was, if we could build machines that can tell us the temperature on the surface of a distant world, detect tanks and weapons in the jungles of foreign countries, then certainly we can transport food from point A to point B and feed people whose lives have been destroyed by war and famine and nature. I began a search for a single principle of unity, a catalyst to carry us beyond our differences, the differences responsible for such suffering as we face the greatest challenges of recorded human history. For most of my adult life, I've had a sense that somewhere in the midst of our ancient memory, we were left a clue to help us understand who we are as individuals, who we are as a species, and with that clue, a reason to look beyond the beliefs that may have separated us in the past and lead us into an era of peace, cooperation, hope, and possibility. From ancient temples and tombs, buried underneath centuries of sand and debris, to fragmented texts and monasteries in the mountains of Egypt and the high deserts of Peru, the American desert southwest, for nearly two decades, my search has continued, and it's in these places that the ancients found themselves on a very similar search. Well, it's in these places as well that our ancestors left clues to a lost knowledge for those who would follow in their footsteps. If we have the wisdom to recognize their gifts, and we can find within ourselves the courage to honor the legacy of their search, we may find that the answers to our greatest mysteries are closer than we think. This program is a story of my search for precisely such clues. Through a blend of true life stories, leading-edge science, ancient texts, and direct experience, over the next few hours, together we'll develop the concepts and the applications, the literal instructions for a timeless wisdom that was left to us by those who have laid the foundation of our world today. Through their understanding, we are given new meaning to each moment and every day of our lives. So I invite you to join me on a journey. This is a journey of exploration, discovery, mystery, and insight. It leads us to the powerful wisdom of the ancients and to the knowledge of what they call the most powerful force, the single most powerful force in the universe. It's a force that lives within every one of us. And with that knowledge, we find the empowering message of hope and possibility that lives within us as well today. So I'd like to begin with a story that came to me a number of years ago. And I can't really even remember who it was that shared the story or where it came from. What I do remember is that it moved me so deeply. It brought me to tears the very first time I heard this story. And it also helped me to understand the concept of the field of energy that links all of creation in the traditions of the ancients and the implications of that concept. It's a true story of a young Jewish boy and his father in the 20th century. And as the Jewish boy was coming of age, he began to question the traditions that he had been raised in, and what they meant to him and the validity of those traditions. And his father took the questioning very personally and was offended by the questioning. And the boy said to his father, "I understand I've been raised in these traditions," he said, "but I need to go out into the world and find if these traditions really hold true for me in my life. I have to see these things for myself." And the father said to him, "If you turn your back on the traditions that we have raised you within, and if you turn your back on me, I have no son, you're no longer my son." And the boy said, "I'm sorry, Father, this is what I have to do." And he did, and he left the United States, and he began to tour the world, and he went into Europe just to find out what the world was like and how his teachings would serve him in his interactions with other people. Years went by, he and his father had absolutely no contact at all. He met a girl, and he settled down, and was living a happy life in an urban society, and one day, into the cafe where they were having their coffee, a friend of his walked in from America that he had not seen since he left. And they were very happy to see one another, and the first thing that his friend said to him, to the boy, he says, "I'm so sorry to hear about the death of your father." And this is the first time the young boy had heard that his father had died. And he immediately came back to the States, and he began speaking to the people in the neighborhood and to their friends and to the family regarding his relationship with his father. And what he discovered very quickly was that his father, in fact, had never forgotten him at all. That his father had spoke of his son incessantly and how proud he was of his son, the strength and the courage that he had to go into the world and find his own way. And it brought the young boy back into the roots of his Hebrew traditions, the Jewish faith. And he said, "I'm going to go to the place where this belief system began, to where it all originated." He found himself in Jerusalem, and he went to a place where people performed their prayers on a daily basis. It's called the Wailing Wall, or the West Wall. And it's a fascinating wall, very ancient stone blocks with mortar that has held them together for many, many centuries. And the wall is so ancient that the mortar has begun to fall out in certain places. And in place of where the mortar has been, there are little tiny pieces of paper and scraps of cloth that are rolled up and stuffed into all of the little crevices and the nooks and crannies. And on each one of those pieces of cloth or paper is a prayer that someone has inscribed and placed. And the tradition that brought him back to where his roots had begun, the boy also inscribed a prayer honoring his relationship with his father. And as he scanned the wall with his eyes, searching for just the right place where he could leave his prayer to honor his relationship with his father, all of a sudden, a prayer that someone else had placed in an earlier time dropped out at his feet. And he bent down to pick this up, to replace it in the wall. And as he did, he happened to notice some of the writing on the prayer. And it was the writing of his father. And he opened the prayer, and what he found was that before his death, his father had journeyed to precisely the same place and had left a prayer giving thanks for his relationship with his son and the beauty that his son brought into his life. And in that moment, the boy was brought back to his roots and to the understanding that even though his father perhaps is no longer in this world, there was still that link, there was still a communication that had occurred between them. And when I hear stories like this, while I'm not surprised, I'm always in awe. I'm in awe of the process because it tells me two things. First of all, when I share this story with others, within myself, even though I've shared it many, many times, it creates a feeling in my body. And perhaps you had that feeling as well when you heard me describe how he looked at his father's handwriting and the synchronicity of seeing that on that prayer, a little piece of paper. And in that feeling lives a power. And it's a power that we are only beginning to understand here in the West. It's a power that transcends what we think of in our minds. It is the power of human emotion and human feeling that can only come about from a genuine experience of emotion in our hearts rather than the logic of our minds. So I'm sharing this story now to begin our program, hopefully to share with you, the listener, an idea perhaps of what that feeling is all about. The second reason that this story is so important to me is because for this kind of an event to occur, obviously there had to be some kind of communication between the young boy and his father. On some level, there was a communication there. In our world, in our Western science today, absolutely nothing allows, up until very recently, there's been nothing that allows for that kind of communication. And the question is whether the boy and his father were in the same country or not, or if the father was even in this world or not. Obviously, something happened between the two of them, and the question is, what is the conduit? What was it that was allowing that communication to transcend space and time? And for that boy to be in precisely the same place where his father had been at some time very recently, doing precisely the same ritual that his father had done, what was it that became the conduit for that experience? Well, the answer to that question and the understanding of the quality of feeling that a story like this creates in our bodies leads us into the essence of what our program is all about. Almost universally, ancient texts and traditions and our most cherished history, they tell us in the language of another time that the events of the world around us and the healing and the joy or the sadness within our bodies are directly related. That they're related in ways that in the West we've only begun to understand, on the one hand. Now, on the other hand, within the last years of the 20th century, Western science began to validate precisely such relationships. Between 1993 and the year 2000, Western science, under laboratory conditions, began to establish the fact that we are surrounded by a field of what is called unconventional energy. It permeates all of creation. It's not out there around us somewhere. It is part of us. It permeates every cell of our body and every element of creation. This field that has only been recently discovered is characterized as being everywhere all of the time. It's a field that apparently has been with us from the moment that creation began, from the time scientists call the Big Bang. And what makes this field so very, very interesting is that scientists today describe this field as having an intelligence. They say that we are permeated with an intelligent field that responds to coherent human emotion, to genuine states of heart-based emotion, joy or sadness, happiness, frustration. The field around us responds by mirroring back into our lives the very experiences that we're having within our bodies. In recent times, Western scientists have begun to call this field the mind of God. And it is in the mind of God that we begin to understand that we are, in fact, participating in the events of our lives, in the events of our world. The peace between nations, the healing in our bodies, as different as they appear, they are related through a single field of energy. And that field of energy is the subject of our program today. I know if you're in this room, what I know about you, I don't know everyone in this room, but if you're in this room, what I know about you is you're the people in your family who the rest of the family has always thought was kind of out there a little bit. Well, in a good way. And when I say out there, it's not out there in left or right field. It's out there about 10 years ahead of your time. Because the way you look at your lives and the events of your world, your interpretations, your perceptions, it didn't make sense 10 years ago. You're the people now that your family comes to and says, what in the world is going on? What's happening in my body? What's happening in our world? Why does it look like everything is falling apart? You're the people that your friends and family turn to in times of crisis and need because they know that you have a way of thinking that's out of the box, if you will. So for you, the information that's in here, I think, becomes a framework for every path that you would ever choose. Any kind of healing, any kind of knowing, whether it's a meditative or a prayer path, whether it's a religious or a spiritual path, scientific or a technical path, you'll find the place for that information within the framework of what we do here today. A few months ago, I had the opportunity, the honor and the privilege of sharing much of what you're going to see today with 1,750 high school students in a very progressive high school in the Pacific Northwest who invited me to come in as their senior seminar. And they allowed me to share this material with them from 8:30 in the morning until 2:30 in the afternoon. And I was in good company. They've had former astronauts have been to senior seminars before, physicists. It's a public school district. I worked very closely with the school district to create the curricula that we were using and danced delicately around topics of religion, spirituality, because these kids, when they go home, kids, they're not kids, these are young adults, and I'll tell you, they are brilliant young adults. And they go home and their parents say, so what'd you do at school today? It's very easy to take things out of context. So we did this program, and when I opened it up to questions, the very first question in the audience was the question that said, isn't everything you're talking about the kind of information that's on the scrolls that are in the box hidden underneath the Sphinx in Giza in the Hall of Records that hasn't been discovered yet? And I said, well, how do you know about that? And they said, well, that's the place where Moses put the Ten Commandments when he came down off the mountain. And I said, well, who told you all this? And they said, well, it's on the Internet. So I knew right off the bat, I mean, this audience of young people, the very, very different. Okay, I'm just going to tell you. I'm going to share with you the story of how excited they were. So thrilled to have this kind of information. They asked me to teach the science that was so new, it has not yet made it into textbooks on the one hand. On the other hand, these are the young people that will be solving the problems that we leave from our lifetime in their lifetimes. And if they're trying to do it with the tools of today, it simply will not work. So they asked me to come and share with them, I'm goosebumps just talking about it, to share with them the science, the themes of that science. Well, how many are familiar with the television program Stargate? Have you ever seen Stargate? Stargate. It's also a movie. Stargate is a huge circular artifact. It's a ring within a ring that supposedly is found in the deserts of Egypt, resurrected by an archaeologist early in the 20th century in the movie Stargate. And there's an inner ring and an outer ring with hieroglyphic symbols all over it. And when they move in the right direction, they open up a stargate, a warp in space-time to allow people to move in and out of space-time. Well, this high school constructed a 30-foot tall stargate ring within a ring that moved in, and they moved within one another. They had red lights all around the top, a dry ice smoke machine from behind, and a ramp, and this is how they asked me to come into their room to make my entrance.
It was over in 15 seconds. And they worked weeks on this. Bless their hearts. I was just so honored. Because they said, this is the information from another time. This is how their minds were working. And they didn't let me get away with anything. One of the first statements I made to them, I said to them, we're living in a time unlike any other time in recorded history, which is true. And, as they pointed out to me, that is true of any time in history. Any time in history is a time like any other time. We are living in a time, as you sense, unlike any other time. And of the many unique ways that I could describe this period in human history, this is the very first time in recorded human history when the fate of our entire species rests upon the choices of a single generation. A single generation. We now are making choices of science, technology, religion, political choices that are determining the fate of nations, the quality of our gene pool, whether we love or hate one another in ways that we have never been able to do in recorded human history. And one of the things that makes this so unique is that to accompany those choices, we now have powers at our fingertips that have historically been left to God and nature. We now have the power at our fingertips to customize our gene pool. We can change the color of our children's eyes, what kind of an intelligence quotient they may have in their lives, their hair color. We have the ability to customize our weather patterns. We can create forms of matter in life that have never been created before. In the past, if a choice was made in one generation that wasn't such a good choice, the next generation could fix that. We're making choices now with consequences that are permanent and lasting. Will be felt for hundreds of generations into our future. We have never had anything like that in recorded human history. Maybe something happened before the records that we have today. Choices that we're making in our time, in our generation, the choices that we make in terms of technology and religion, in terms of science, in medicine, for the first time in recorded human history, these choices carry consequences that we cannot undo. Always in the past, if a generation made a choice that did not serve them well, they would simply say, well, we won't do that again. We can no longer do that. When we talk about changing the genetic code of a species, when we speak about the implications of nuclear technologies, the evolution of our bodies, the DNA in our bodies, for example, it has taken hundreds and thousands of years for us to arrive at what is called the genetic recipe that allows us to work however well we believe we work in our world. What are the implications if we, in one generation, intercede and change that genetic recipe in response to a single threat? For example, there is a proposal that we change our genetic code to make us immune to the anthrax virus because it appears to be a threat in this generation right now. And I believe we can probably do this. However, what are the long-term implications? Do we really know what it means to us? If 30 years from now, another virus comes into our populations, by making that change now, have we somehow compromised the wisdom and the intelligence of our body to take care of us in another generation? And the truth is, the best scientists of our time will tell us we really don't know the answer to that. We really don't know. The evolution of our bodies, the stability of nations, the peace of our world, literally hang in the balance of the choices that we're making in the single generation, keys to our very survival right now. So we can say, without exaggeration, that for the first time in recorded human history, we have at our fingertips the power to preserve or to destroy all that we cherish as a species. And that is an awesome, awesome power for us to have. And there's a tremendous responsibility that comes with us understanding that kind of power. The great irony of our time in history is that in the presence of such power that gives us what appear to be miraculous technologies, on the one hand, children are still orphaned, families destroyed from preventable disease, from malnutrition, from viral epidemics that sweep seemingly unchallenged across entire continents. with the knowledge of peace and how to create peace available to the largest populations ever recorded in our planet's history, we still witness the horrors of war, induced famine, senseless acts of hate, and we have to ask ourselves the question, why? Why are these things happening simultaneously? How can we have such wisdom when it comes to understanding the world around us on the one hand, and on the other hand, why does it appear that we lack the wisdom to apply what we know to end the suffering and to make the lives of our families and our communities and our global family that much better? Well, perhaps one of the answers to this question may come from a term that astronomer Carl Sagan coined before his death in 1996. Before he died, Sagan looked at our time in history and he looked at the uniqueness of the things that we're identifying right now. And what he said was, he said, we are in fact living a very unique time of history. It's a time that he called technological adolescence. Technological adolescence, what a fascinating term. It's a term that implies there's something young about our understanding. What Sagan began to understand was that we as a species have reached a time where we have acquired the powers of creation, where we can tap into the forces of the universe on the one hand, and on the other hand, we are still learning the maturity and the wisdom of what it means to use that power responsibly in our lives. Sagan's question before he died was, will we survive our learning curve? Will we learn quick enough to gain the wisdom to survive the powers that we now have at our fingertips? One of our visionaries and one of the brilliant scientists of our time, Dr. Michio Kaku, co-author of the superstring theory, coined a beautiful quote a few years ago. He said, for most of human history, we could only watch the beautiful dance of nature. He said, but today, we're on the cusp of an epic-making transition from being what he called passive observers of nature to being active choreographers. If we are, in fact, the choreographers of technology and nature, as Michio Kaku suggests, then it gives even greater credibility to what Carl Sagan said about our time of technological adolescence. Is it possible that technology has grown faster in some respects than the wisdom of how we apply it in our lives? I invite you as a listener, just think about what has happened even in the last 50 years, the ability to engineer our genes, the way that we can now manipulate viruses and bacteria, nuclear energy, what it means to us and how we apply it in our lives. Do you ever get the feeling somehow that we've learned these things faster than we learn how to apply them or what they mean in our lives? Well, we have to ask ourselves, do we truly understand how these choices affect our world? Do we really know what they mean? Do we really have the wisdom to apply our newfound powers wisely in our world? I found some very interesting statistics. 100 years ago, our world was way different than it is today. 100 years ago, most women washed their hair only once a month. Taking notes already. Am I about to say anything profound? This is it. And when they did wash their hair, they used borax and egg yolks for shampoo. Only 100 years ago. 100 years ago, in this country, there were only 144 miles of paved road. Can you believe that? 144 miles. How many automobiles do you think were available to drive on those 144 miles? 8,000. 8,000 cars to drive on them. We now have the ability to modify our weather patterns in ways that we've never done before. Many people are unaware of this. People say, do you mean seed the clouds to create rain? Well, yes, we do that. We also have the ability to create high pressure systems wherever we would like to have them. Low pressure systems to move masses of weather around. We can prevent droughts when we do that. We can bring life-giving water to portions of the earth that have never had water. Is it right, wrong, good, or bad? We don't know right now. We don't know. To create new forms of matter that have never been seen in this world before. When we take the elements of the earth that occur naturally and we force them together under artificial temperatures and pressures, in the ancient texts, they call that the perversion of matter. They say because it would never happen under natural circumstances. Is it right, wrong, good, or bad? What are we saying to our world and what are we doing to our world when we do this? And when we engineer brand new forms of life, we now are
tinkering with the ancient code that has brought life to our world in ways we know how to do. We may not understand the implications of what these things are actually leaving us. All of these are powers historically that have only been left what we call the force of God and the power of nature. There are questions now. There are scientists who are asking, if we now have the powers that have been historically left to God and nature, are we becoming gods ourselves? Many people are speculating about that. Our choices today, we are setting the standards of technology, religion, medicine. These are the choices today that have the lasting consequences, consequences that are forever going to be felt in the evolution of our bodies, the stability of our nations, and the peace of our world. Do you feel that? Do you feel that we are being asked to make choices today? The magnitude of those choices, unlike anything we've ever known in the past. When you watch the 6 o'clock news, do you ever feel that? Do you ever feel like we don't have all the information? As good as the information is, it may be something is missing. I feel that way. These are the keys to the survival of our species. Nothing less. And that is why I am so passionate and absolutely thrilled to be able to share this with you today, because in a very real sense, this is precisely what all of this work is about. We're talking about nothing less than the survival of humankind.
Just before the turn of the century, the birth of the new millennium, January of 1999, the World Watch Institute released a study, it's a fascinating study, on the state of the world as they saw it in that moment. In the first sentence of the new study, and this is a quote, it said, "The bright promise of a new century is clouded by unprecedented threats to the stability of our natural world." And the article went on to describe what these threats look like and how they would appear in our lives. And to me, the most fascinating thing was that the single greatest threat that they identified, it wasn't nuclear technology, it wasn't the engineering of viruses or bacteria. The single greatest threat to our species they identified was humankind itself. They said, we are our own greatest threat to our future survival. And they went on to describe how the use of the technology that we've created in our lives has given new meaning to the way we perceive ourselves and the way we define ourselves by our similarities or our differences. Technology that we have today has given new meaning to the way we see ourselves and our differences. At the beginning of our new millennium, at the turn of the last century, now that century is over, historians can go back and they can compile the statistics and they can tell us what the last 100 years really meant to us. Rather than coming from an emotional standpoint of what we feel the last 100 years were like, they can actually go back and tell us. And some of the statistics are a little frightening. Between 1900 and 1999, what we know is that more people lost their lives at the hands of our own kind than at any other time in recorded human history. Jonathan Steele from the British journal Guardian Unlimited Observer actually coined the sentence. He said, "This is a century that murdered peace." Eric Hobsbawm, the historian, in his book War and Peace in the 20th Century, called the 20th century the single most murderous century in recorded human history. And I have to say, when I began reading these kinds of quotes, I questioned them. Because I always thought that the bloodiest time in human history was the Inquisition or the Romans. They were pretty bad, hundreds and thousands of years ago. And I began to read the statistics, and they were very frightening. In the last 100 years alone, over 187 million human lives were lost to violence based simply in the differences between people, the differences between bloodlines, heritage, borders, beliefs, simply because people were different. And that number, it's such a huge number, it's almost meaningless. 187 million of anything. I don't know what 187 million of anything even looks like. So maybe to give some perspective, if we take the entire population of the earth in 1913 and consider that 10% of that population is about 187 million, that gives us some idea. About 10% of the earth's population in 1913. That is the number of people that lost their lives in the last 100 years simply because they were different in some way. Now, what's very interesting about this is while we have become a species that is defined by our differences, and perhaps we always have to some degree, the emphasis in those differences has grown tremendously in this last century. The last century saw a rise in a new form of killing. It was justified in our differences to the point that new terms had to be coined just to describe this kind of killing. The terms of genocide, ethnic cleansing. 1948, the United Nations General Assembly actually defined the word genocide so that they could make it illegal in the world courts. They defined it as a denial of the right of existence of entire human groups. There's a reason I'm sharing this information. There's a reason that I'm sharing these statistics now. The reason is because at the birth of the 21st century, the very parameters that created such frightening statistics of the last 100 years are still in place. The thinking that led to such tremendous loss of life, that thinking still exists. The violence of the last century has continued. Right now, the United States is actively involved in at least 22 wars. We have troops on the ground in 22 wars throughout the world. We don't hear a lot about this in our everyday lives. And the peacekeeping missions even compound those to a greater degree. And what I think all of these things are telling us is that peace must be more than the absence of war. Peace has to be more than the absence of war. While we can have peacekeeping troops on the ground to force people to stop fighting, the peacekeeping troops do not necessarily force the peace within people's hearts. And this is where the field of energy that links all of creation that the ancients identified, that Western science now understands, this is where that field of energy becomes so important to our understanding and our ability to participate in the changes of our world, to change the patterns of the war, the disease, and the suffering that dominated so much of the last century. We simply must change the thinking that underlies that pattern. And I know it sounds very simple, so simple that people ask me, why haven't we done these things yet? From the mid-1980s through the end of the Cold War, I was fortunate enough to work in the aerospace industry, and interestingly enough, was assigned a position in the defense sector of the aerospace industry. It's interesting, when you get a job working in defense, what they actually do, the companies will hire you before you actually are assigned your position. And they'll bring you into the company, and then 8 or 10 months later, when your security clearance comes through, you get to find out what your real job will be. So one day, I was called into the office. I was already an employee, and I was given my assignment. And they said, your assignment is going to be the Peacekeeper missile. And I felt really good about that because it sounded good. It sounded anything to do with peace. I thought it was probably a good thing to do. And I was leaving the office, walking down the hall, and a friend of mine stopped me. He said, did you get your assignment? And I said, yes. And he said, what is it? I said, well, it's the Peacekeeper missile. And he looked at me and he laughed. And I said, well, what is the Peacekeeper missile? And he said, that is the code word for the MX missile, which is the United States deterrent to the Soviets throughout the Cold War. During the time of the Cold War, we lived under the umbrella of a very, very bizarre strategy that is called MADD, Mutually Assured Destruction and Deterrence. And by any stretch of the imagination, it is such a strange strategy to think about. During the Cold War era, the United States had a technology that was called the MX missile. And the idea, the thinking was that in the event of a nuclear exchange, we would survive this exchange. If we could get one of our missiles off of the ground, it would go into a low orbit and release 10 independently targetable warheads that would come back down to 10 different cities somewhere in the world. And we built 50 of these. And at that time, the Russians said, we can't match your technology. We can't build something like that. So we'll just build our nuclear missiles so big, if they get within a few miles of the target, they're going to vaporize everything anyway, and that's our answer to your MX missile. And you and I lived under that strategy for a number of years, all the way up through the end of the Cold War. And I'm sharing this story because the thinking at that time was that although the technology would work, it was never really meant to be used. It was built as a deterrent to war. I'm making comparison because in the last couple of years now, in the 21st century, there's a new thinking. It's the thinking that allows us to develop nuclear devices on a smaller level, mini nukes. They're called tactical battlefield nukes. These are nuclear devices that can be fired from a shoulder or from a small cannon and are designed to be used under battlefield conditions. These are no longer used for deterrence to war. They have now become weapons of war. In my opinion, when we cross the line that allows us to do something like that under battlefield conditions, we've crossed a very dangerous line. And we have to ask ourselves the question, the thinking that led to the violence of the last 100 years, do we have the wisdom to find a way to transcend that thinking? And I believe that we have the opportunity now to make those kinds of choices. I'm not saying these technologies are right, wrong, good, or bad. I'm inviting us to have the wisdom to know how to apply them in our lives in a meaningful and responsible way. So now, at the birth of our 21st century, we're at a dangerous crossroads in our evolution. We are at a time of technological adolescence, when we have at our fingertips the powers of creation in ways that we've never had before. We become a species defined by our differences, the differences of our bloodlines, our heritage, our borders, our beliefs. At the same time, we're willing to justify the use of advanced technology. We destroy one another, and we have in the past, based simply in those differences. If we're going to transcend the statistics of our last century, if we're going to master the wisdom of what it means to have the power of creation at our fingertips, we must begin looking at ourselves and our world very, very differently. We've got to see the interconnected nature between us and the world around us and one another and perhaps the cosmos beyond. So now the science, the very science that's given us the power to preserve or destroy all that we love and hold dear, now must solve the single greatest mystery of all. We've got to find out who we are. We've got to understand ourselves, perhaps in ways that we never have in the past. And in the understanding of ourselves, we will know of our relationship to one another in our world, how to find the wisdom to apply our newfound powers wisely, and how to transcend, not just survive, but to transcend, to become more than the greatest challenges of recorded human history. This program is designed to explore and lead us on a journey for precisely these purposes, to understand what the ancients knew about our time in history, what the ancients knew of the force that links all of creation together, and of how to apply that in our lives in terms of our relationships now in the 21st century, in terms of our jobs, our families, our careers, our health, and the peace between nations. All are linked through a single force that Western science now is only beginning to understand. I invite you to join me on this journey of exploration and discovery and mystery as we explore the field that links all of creation in ways we're only beginning to understand, the field that Western science now is beginning to call the mind of God.